Today on Annenberg Radio News.
That's hope that we can touch and that we can feel and that we can participate in, and that's the wave of the future.
A Muslim convention in a Christian church draws hate mail to Pasadena. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Thursday, December 6, 2012. I'm Kristen Nakashioya. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villagrosa announced a deal today that will harness the power of the sun. He gave details about two new solar energy contracts that he says will help Los Angeles get off coal power completely in just over a decade. Omar Shamoot has details.
On a foggy Los Angeles morning, Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa touted the largest solar energy deal ever negotiated by the Department of Water and Power. The city is partnering with two Nevada-based companies, K Road Moapa Power, north of Las Vegas, and Copper Mountain 3 outside of Henderson. Copper 3 is owned by Semper U.S. Gas and Power, which is based in San Diego. Altogether, these two companies will fuel over 190,000 L.A. homes. DWP says it currently provides green energy to around 330,000 of its 1.4 million customers. The mayor said the city is on the right track.
We're one of the few public utilities in the United States that is at 20% renewables. We'll be at 33% renewables by 2020.
That goal comes from a state renewable energy mandate Governor Brown called the most aggressive in the nation. The mayor said he expects Los Angeles to be completely free from coal power soon after that.
By 2023, we will be out of the coal business in the city of Los Angeles.
That transition will cost DWP customers between $15 and $18 per year in rate increases. But the mayor said because the city acted early to meet the mandate, they were able to make deals below the current average for solar prices.
As everybody starts ramping up to get to that 33%, I can almost guarantee you that price is going to start to go up.
The two Nevada companies were chosen because they're close to lines that currently pump coal power to L.A. Tom Sales, president of the DWP Board of Commissioners, said building new transmission lines to California solar sites was too expensive.
Whatever we buy, we're trying to buy it at the lowest possible cost. The suppliers are relatively close to transmission lines, which brings down the overall cost of the project.
But long-range power sources can be problematic, too. Ralph Knowles, a professor emeritus from USC's School of Architecture and an expert on solar policy, is hesitant about the deal.
There are very serious problems, and we see it all the time. Every time there's a storm, we see power going out, and it goes out because these lines are susceptible.
Knowles said LA should look closer to home for sources of renewable energy. He'd start with rooftops in the city's industrial corridors.
A real hard look at all of that rooftop capacity has not been done, and the resulting amount of power that could be generated on that much horizontal surface.
The city is working to get more local companies involved, according to Sales.
We're in discussions. One of the problems is as we negotiate these, I certainly can't identify them, but clearly we would like to have in-basin solar generation.
Time is money, but the city still has 8 years to close the renewable energy gap. Omar Shamoot, Annenberg Radio News.
Fresh and Easy customers are taking in the news today that the British grocery chain may be shutting down its stores in the United States. Catherine Davis headed to a Fresh and Easy neighborhood market today to find out what that might mean for South LA.
For many shoppers around LA,
thank you for shopping at Fresh and Easy,
has become a familiar sound. British supermarket chain Tesco started opening Fresh and Easy neighborhood markets in California, Arizona, and Nevada in 2007. In LA, the chain has opened stores in several underserved neighborhoods.
I used to go to Food for Less to buy my meats. I come here because, heck, it's good. You know, the meats, the chicken, all that is tender. Over there was hard. And I couldn't even eat the chicken over there anymore.
That's Manny Castro, a regular at the Fresh and Easy on Adams and Central in South L.A. Fresh and Easy also has locations in Huntington Park and Compton and had proposed a store in Crenshaw, which never opened because of building restrictions in that neighborhood. In these neighborhoods, convenience stores and discount grocers abound, but big stores like Ralph's, Vaughn's, or Albertson's are scarce. Public policy experts refer to areas like South LA, where access to fresh produce is limited, as food deserts. For many, Fresh and Easy offered a nice oasis. Richard Cuevas shops at the Adams Street Fresh and Easy several times a week.
It's one of my favorite stores, actually. It's the food, the quality of all their stuff that they carry is fresh. I like it. Actually, the name really goes for it, Fresh and Easy.
In 5 years, Tesco opened 199 Fresh and Easy markets in the U.S. Now all of those stores could close. Philip Clark, CEO of Tesco, said yesterday, quote, "It is likely but not certain that our presence in America will come to an end." Tesco has 500,000 employees in 14 different countries. But business in the USA has not been going well. Manny Castro says of the Adams Street Fresh and Easy,
"This one's been dead."
Fresh and Easy already closed 7 locations in California earlier this year. Now Castro hopes his Fresh and Easy isn't going anywhere.
"Well, this is the best store in the neighborhood. Better than going to the market and, you know, parking here, everything. It's perfect."
It is not clear yet whether Tesco will sell their American stores or just close them down. Catherine Davis, Annenberg Radio News.
There's a new religious conflict in L.A., but in this case, cooperation between Muslims and Christians is upsetting some people. An Episcopal church in Pasadena announced Friday it will host the annual Muslim Public Affairs Council convention. Since then, All Saints Church has received about 5 hate messages a day. Edina Lukovich of the Muslim Public Affairs Council says they sort of expected that reaction.
"That's, you know, this sort of comes with the territory, and I think that that's what's beautiful about what's happening, is that I don't think that anybody is deterred from the path that we're on. All Saints is certainly not wavering because of this. They are, in fact, more emboldened because it simply shows how important it is what we are doing and how important it is to make this normal and mainstream."
Lukovich says to her knowledge, a Muslim organization has never held a convention in the Christian church. About 1,000 people, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, are expected to attend.
"And I think that by holding a national Muslim convention in a Christian church, that's hope that we can not just believe in, but that's hope that we can touch and that we can feel and that we can participate in. And that's the wave of the future."
The convention starts next Saturday, December 15th. With the holidays just around the corner, some of you might be getting a little overwhelmed by the materialism of it all, but that doesn't have to be the case. Reporter Molly Gray shows us one way that gift-giving can be a little more worthwhile.
A growing trend of socially responsible organizations are trying to turn gift-giving into a charitable effort, in more ways than one. You've probably heard of Tom's Shoes. For every pair of shoes that is bought in the United States or throughout the developed world, Tom's donates a pair of shoes to a child in need. Or perhaps you have purchased a bottle of Ethos water from your local Starbucks. The company donates a nickel for every bottle purchased toward water sanitation and hygiene around the world. But before there were Tom's or Ethos water, there was Spiral.
"Well, when you shop at Spiral, really 100% returns to the beneficiaries."
That's Marike Simchik, founder of the Spiral Foundation. When you walk into her home in the Pacific Palisades, it's like entering another world. As patron John Hagelberg puts it,
"When I walk in here, my heart goes, and my eyes and my heart goes, wow, this is so cool."
Each year around the holidays, Simchik rearranges her home to accommodate thousands of items to be sold for charity. The bags, dolls, rugs, and jewelry cover the rooms from floor to ceiling. All of these trinkets are made by the people her charity benefits.
"We work in Vietnam, in Nepal, and in Rome, Italy, trying to start handicraft workshops where artisans recycle discarded materials and transform these discarded materials in beautiful and useful and happy items."
Simchik has been helping people from South Asia and Africa sell homemade goods since 1997. The goods are made from old plastic bottles, newspaper, and magazines, or discarded materials from factories.
All proceeds from sale return to them in the form of fair salaries or humanitarian aid projects for their community.
A collection that caught my eye was jewelry made from old tire rubber.
"Those are made again in Italy by African refugees arrived in Italy in search of protection. And they're black and really cool. And we have earrings, we have bracelets that are really cool because they look kind of like tattoos.
The Spiral Foundation first began after Simchik and her husband took a trip to Vietnam.
I became aware of how much of the destruction caused by the Vietnam War was still present in Vietnam. It wasn't something that belonged to the past. It was something still so present.
Since then, Spiral has employed more than 1,000 people in Vietnam and Nepal, supplied aid to health clinics, and donated money to schools and adult educational foundations. In all, Spiral has raised $1.8 million. The nonprofit organization Shop With Meaning catalogs companies like Spiral that it says are socially responsible. According to their website, Shop With Meaning has cataloged hundreds of businesses. The organization highlights companies that are transparent with how their revenues go to charity, and they also require companies to support fair trade and sustainability. John Hagelberg has been coming to the Spiral sale for years and says he is amazed by the quality of the work produced through Spiral.
In this country, recycling is taking old plastic bottles and tin cans and aluminum cans and melting them down and turning them into new plastic cans and bottles. But here we see taking recyclable trash and turning it into art.
Hagelberg's daughter, Julia, is raising money for a trip to Nepal with her high school class and says Simchik has motivated her to serve others.
I mean, I think it's really interesting, and it's a great idea, and I really like the idea of helping people. And so I just wanted to, you know, do something and just sort of start when I'm a young age so I can have more confidence to do more stuff when I'm older.
Julia's got what Simchik says is most important when people shop with Spiral. Heart. Molly Gray, Annenberg Radio News.
For more information about the Spiral sale happening this weekend, visit www.spiralfoundation.org. And now for this weekend's weather forecast. Tonight we'll have clear skies and a chilly low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow, Los Angeles can expect a high of 73 as well as sunny skies. Saturday, we'll see the sun come out again and a high that drops down to 68. Sunday will be a high of 72 and partly cloudy, but we're still not expecting any rain this weekend. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we'll meet a man who's stuffed with interesting stories at the Natural History Museum. Do you know who is the richest man in the world? If you guessed Bill Gates, you would be wrong. The world's wealthiest man is Carlos Slim. He's a telecom magnate in Mexico worth some $69 billion. But now Slim and his fattest company are facing protests because his company refuses to help fund programs for the poor. Today in Los Angeles, activists held a protest against Slim for his predatory business practices. Max Schwartz reports.
Demonstrators from Vamos Unidos led a protest today outside the California Public Utilities Commission's LA office. They spoke out against a merger between TracFone, a subsidiary of one of Carlos Slim's biggest companies, American Movil, and Simple Mobile, which was affiliated with T-Mobile. Juan Jose Gutierrez is president of Vamos Unidos USA. He says the merger went through in June without any public hearings or review by the California Public Utilities Commission.
We want to let the California Public Utilities Commission that it needs to hold hearings. We want them to do a full investigation to find out how was it that Mr. Carlos Slim's, one of his companies, was able to purchase Simple Mobile.
Gutierrez is angry because TracFone refuses to pay the public services fee that subsidizes utility services for California's poor residents. American Movil is the primary wireless phone company in Latin America. According to its website, it's the fourth largest wireless provider in the world. Slim's company, TracFone, is a prepaid mobile provider that mostly serves immigrant and working class families. So does the California-based Simple Mobile. TracFone's president and CEO, F.J. Pollock, says prepaid phone providers shouldn't have to pay the fee.
Pay phones are excluded, prepaid long-distance cards are excluded, and in our opinion, and that of Verizon and other carriers, prepaid wireless was excluded, And we had not been paying those fees for a long time, and the PUC had known that we weren't paying them.
Gutierrez says Slim had not done enough to give back to the poor population of Mexico, the country in which he made his fortune. Several California lawmakers have introduced legislation aimed at providing more government oversight to these kind of telecom mergers. Max Schwartz, Annenberg Radio News.
A new analysis will detail the economic impact that climate change could have on the winter tourism industry in California and the rest of the nation. The analysis finds that the $12.2 billion ski and snowmobile industry is dependent on heavy and predictable snowfall. Changes in the winter season have already been felt across the nation and are likely to become even more pronounced with climate change. From the Arts District to the banks of the Los Angeles River, downtown L.A. has become a creative hotspot. But just a little hop across the river into the old immigrant quarters of Boyle Heights is another burgeoning but less-traveled scene of mostly Hispanic artists, musicians, and artisans. Melissa Runnels takes us to a little storefront on Cesar Chavez Street where musicians custom-make musical strings by hand.
Alberto Gray, affectionately known as Gorilla, trained as a machinist, and you can tell. Big, solid shoulders, huge hands. Those hands are delicately guiding a string of fine, bright, silvery metal from a spool sitting behind him as it wraps at high speed around a thin metal core strung between the two ends of the string winder, a kind of a lathe for wire. He controls his speed by a foot pedal. It almost looks like he's spinning cotton or wool. Gray works for Guadalupe Custom Strings, one of a handful of shops in the U.S. dedicated to making high-quality custom strings by hand. Guadalupe makes strings for a wide range of stringed instruments, many specific to Latin folk and popular music. Right now, he's making a set of strings for a bajo quinto, a kind of guitar.
Single set would take maybe about 15, 20 minutes, maybe 30 if they give me a hard time. When I first started, it took me about 45 minutes to an hour to make one string.
Gray got into string making through his friend, Jacob Hernandez. Hernandez, who plays several different instruments, learned the craft from a Mexican harper named Francisco Gonzalez. When Gonzalez was ready to quit, Hernandez and his longtime friend, Gabriel Tenorio, took over. Tenorio, who's played with stars like Osamatli and Elvis, said Gonzalez wouldn't sell the store to anyone but musicians. They had to have the love to survive the business.
And that's what Francisco told us from the get-go. It's like, you got to keep on doing music, and you got to do it because of the music. You know, if you try to do it for any other reason, it's not going to work for you because it's not going to be rewarding.
They're all musicians, so they understand how a string makes it sound, how it should look, how it should feel. Here's Hernandez and Tenorio discussing how you can see if a string is good or not.
You take it out of the package and you see that the string is like limp, like it has no life. And then other strings, but when you make it and we hold it up, like the string almost lies flat, you know, and
stored energy.
Yeah, it's the difference between a tortilla made on a machine and a handmade tortilla. It's the same masa, maybe it might be, technically it's the same thing, but when you have someone's hand making something, there's no way to compare. Especially something like this, there's just no way to compare with.
Yeah, a machine only knows to make something precisely, whereas opposed, it's not necessarily equipped to think.
They ask a lot of questions to find out what a musician's looking for. What music do you play? What kind of sound do you want? How do you want the string to feel under your hand?
We don't necessarily have a very friendly website where you can order because we need to talk to our clients.
Their emphasis on high-quality tailored sound has garnered them some high-profile clients in addition to luthiers and retailers. Although they joke about selling to every continent but Africa, they remain rooted in Boyle Heights. All the employees are friends of theirs whom they train. Women in the neighborhood bring the boys food on a daily basis.
They get some fresh orange juice the lady brings. Another lady brings burritos made at home by hand. Everything here is always by hand.
Gray says the vibe makes what could be a tedious job something fun.
It's really not work. It's really coming to hang out with your friends and making money at the same time.
And Hernandez underscores the importance of maintaining that hands-on local vibe.
This is real work for us. We don't see ourselves one day, you know, smoking a cigar in the top room, you know. Like, we're not looking at trying to have a huge company.
Either way, they make it sound almost perfect. Melissa Runnels, Annenberg Radio News.
A new poll reports that Governor Jerry Brown has a record-high job approval rating of 48% after the passage of Prop 30. Nearly half of Californians surveyed said they feel better about the state's budget situation because of the tax initiative. However, there's still concern as 94% of Californians still believe that the state budget situation is a problem. Did you love animals growing up? If you did, you may have wanted to dedicate your adult life to saving them, whether as a vet, a zoologist, or animal researcher. But did you ever consider working with animals after they've died? Probably not. Today, Kat Boza introduces us to one animal lover who decided to do just that.
Tim Bovard handles dead animals for a living. Now, the very thought of that might make most of us squeamish, but Bovard isn't like most of us. He's the head taxidermist at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles. And when you ask him about his work, he'll light up with an enthusiasm that your average adult would reserve for describing a relaxing vacation, not a life spent skinning lemurs that died in captivity or bobcats hit by cars. It's no wonder, though. Bovard has practiced taxidermy for most of his life.
My parents would have said that, you know, they think I was born with this in mind. As a kid, I was already trying to do things, find animals, try and preserve them. I actually mounted my first animal to try and do a realistic life mount. It was when I was 9-10 years old, and it was a skunk.
Bovard grew up in Southern California, and his family would often visit the Natural History Museum. His love of the museum's intricate dioramas fueled his interest in the taxidermy profession.
A lot of people become somewhat fascinated because you never get to see the musculature, typically of animals, because they've got the skin on, and the average person never gets to see that. And there's not as much blood and bad smells and stuff as one might think of.
The taxidermy process is surprisingly simple. Animal specimens are measured to ensure a proper fit over a polyurethane form, then skinned. The skin is salted and placed into a solution for pickling. Yep, pickling.
Pickling is just like doing pickles. It's an acid and a salt. Same idea.
I follow Bovard outside of his office to a workspace covered in machinery, large plastic barrels, and buckets full of salt and animal fat.
It's a little crowded, but this is the flensing room.
He leads me to one barrel tucked away in the corner of the workspace and removes the lid. It's filled to the brim with a briny, murky brown liquid. Bovard plunges his hand inside the barrel and fishes around until he produces a large, sopping wet, but extremely beautiful cow's hide.
So it's in a pickling solution at this point, and if you look at the underneath side, you can see some lines or ridges in it, and what I've been doing is shaving it down. And by doing that, I will control shrinkage.
When the animal's skin reaches the desired thickness, it's put into a tanning bath, then rubbed with oil to ensure the hide won't shrink. From there, the skin is glued to the form. Glass eyes and clay features such as noses and foot pads finish out the mount. The entire process can take 1 or 2 days for small animals and birds. A larger animal, like the cow Bovard is pickling, can take several weeks. Los Angeles' Natural History Museum is one of only several museums that still employs a full-time taxidermist. Most museums use dioramas created at the beginning of the 20th century, so the need for artisans like Bovard has dwindled with the passage of time.
When they had most of their exhibits built, why did they need a taxidermist anymore? In most cases, their exhibits were behind glass and sealed up, and so when the taxidermist retired, often they weren't replaced. Some of our diorama bays, instead of saying being installed in the 20s and never touched since then, have had 3 or 4 different sets of animals in them to kind of update our story.
A skilled taxidermist is intimately familiar with everything from anatomy to sculpture. But the real artistry in taxidermy, says Bovard, is bringing dead animals back to life.
You know, we like live stuff too. That's sometimes intriguing to people who think we're just into the dead stuff. And if you think about it, it makes sense because, yeah, we are working with a dead animal, but we are trying to make it back to what it looked like in life. And that is a challenge. That is the ultimate challenge to me.
If Bovard decides to retire, that doesn't necessarily mean the taxidermy department at the Los Angeles Natural History Museum will disappear. Bovard is currently training two apprentices, ensuring that the taxidermy profession will remain alive for years to come. Kat Boza, Annenberg Radio News.
It's generally accepted that personal stories stick with people more than facts and figures. In the media, that's why we do what we do, try to bring you human stories to illustrate big ideas instead of a slew of statistics. But is it true? Are stories more impactful? A group of USC professors put this notion to the test. They had 1,000 women watch films about cervical cancer. Half got a narrative, half got pure facts. Doe Mayer from USC Cinema School, Sheila Murphy from the Annenberg Communication School, and Lourdes Baez-Conde Garbinati from the School of Medicine teamed up with this project. They spoke with our Aaron Schrenk today.
Explain to me the general problem in terms of health that this experiment sought to address.
What we found is that Latina women in particular have twice the rate of cervical cancer than non-Hispanic whites. And Korean women as well have a very high percentage of cervical cancer incidence when you compare that to other immigrant groups and non-immigrant groups as well.
Certainly. And so what went on here was the creation of two different films that conveyed the same information, the same facts. If you could tell me, though, what type of facts they got across and explain the different approaches in either film.
Right. Well, the idea here is that there's an assumption to many of us that when material's embedded in a story, it's more emotionally compelling. We're more apt to do what it suggests. But there isn't a whole lot of evidence that proves that material embedded in stories necessarily works better than material that's fact-based. And so what we did is we made two 11-minute films. They're exactly the same length. They have exactly the same facts about cervical cancer and how it's prevented. It's about HPV vaccine and about getting pap tests. And the idea was test both these films and try to develop some evidence that when material is embedded in a story, this intuitive idea that we have, this sense of the power of story in our society, is actually works better. That was the idea of the experiment.
What did you find? Did facts and figures win out, or was it story, as the assumption goes?
Actually, so knowledge, attitudes, and behavior moved in the predicted direction for both films, but they moved significantly more for the narrative film. So women who were randomly assigned to hear the story of the quinceañera, it's all about a story surrounding a girl's 15th birthday or quinceañera and her family and finding out that one of the older sisters has HPV virus and what she's doing about it, et cetera. And so that story, the narrative version, actually showed the greatest change at 2 weeks, and we haven't finished the analysis yet for the 6-month follow-up, but we anticipate that that's actually going to hold.
So ultimately, what can we learn from this? What's the takeaway from this for people in film, for media practitioners, for people studying health?
So, you know, I think there has to be this argument that it's more than fact-based. You know, and here is this wonderful experiment designed to really look at this and investigate it in a much more scientific way than those of us, you know, who are storytellers, who are interested and understand the power of story, have been able to do on our own.
I was just going to say that in terms of prevention, it's a really key study because it could really change and transform how we provide education in general for all different groups in the future.
That was Lourdes Baez-Conde Garbinati, Sheila Murphy, and Doe Mayer. Their project was funded by the National Cancer Institute. Now we check in with Kim Leffler to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision.
Thanks, Kristen. Coming up tonight, Jordan Lee talks to Occupy protesters about home foreclosures. Clippers point guard Chris Paul surprises L.A. kids with Christmas gifts. And our weather anchor Chelsea Goss gives us a holiday checklist. It's all coming up tonight on Annenberg TV News at 6 on Trojan Vision.
And now, a whale of the tale from Malibu. Authorities today are hard at work trying to remove a 20-ton whale carcass that washed up on the beach. Marine experts who've taken a look at the 41-foot fin whale think the poor guy may have been struck by a ship before landing on shore. How do you dispose of a huge dead whale? The normal method is to tow the carcass out at least 10 miles out to sea and wait for the sharks. The Los Angeles City Council christened Ray Bradbury Square at the intersection of 5th and Flower today. Bradbury moved to L.A. when he was 14 and wrote Fahrenheit 451 in the basement of a UCLA library. Bradbury died in June at age 91. That's it. That's it for this Thursday and for the semester. We'd like to thank our Thursday reporting staff, Melissa Runners, Omar Shamut, Denise Guerra, Max Swartz, and Catherine Davis. We also had help from ATVN's Sam Weiser, Joel Zink, and Timothy Beckworth. Rosalie Murphy is our producer. Our executive producer is Aaron Schrenk. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Kristen Nakashioya.